What is a corporate tax inversion, you may ask? If you give a monkey a camera, will he also want a copyright? And what really is the rule of law? That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 40A&M N5, the weekly download of 40A&M LLC. It's Monday, August 11th, and I'm Chris Bohm. First up, during the last decade, 47 U.S. companies have moved their tax reporting status abroad, according to Congressional Research Service data reported by USA Today's Kevin McCoy last week, a practice dubbed a corporate tax inversion. And it is believed that 12 more are either pursuing or researching potential shifts, including the Illinois-based pharmaceutical and medical devices giant Medtronic. It is for this reason that Treasury Secretary Jack Lowe has ordered the department to explore ways to unilaterally block a surge of U.S. companies shifting their headquarters overseas. A move under federal executive branch authority could at least provide a partial fix while awaiting potential congressional action that could take effect retroactively. Congress has hardly been silent on this issue over the past few weeks, with Senators Dick Durbin of Illinois, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, and Jack Reed of Rhode Island, all Democrats, coming together last week to urge President Obama to take action in lieu of congressional efforts. The Deerfield, Illinois-based Walgreens is the latest high-profile U.S. company to be reportedly considering a move for tax purposes, although as of Tuesday of last week, the company is said to have ended its exploration. Shares of Walgreens fell more than 4% in trading on Tuesday after several news outlets reported the new decision by the drugstore chain. Within the past year alone, six U.S. companies have reportedly taken this tax move, according to analysis reported last week in the Wall Street Journal. The draft legislation now being circulated on Capitol Hill comes from Congressman Sandra Levin, Democrat of Michigan, and part of its aim would be to make it more difficult for companies that do relocate for tax purposes to access the earnings of other foreign companies that the parent controls that also are required to pay U.S. taxes on those earnings. In addition, the draft would close a loophole in the tax code that presently permits companies that do relocate overseas from also taking deductions on the interest payments for intercompany loans, a practice known as income stripping. As Congress, now in recess, considers where next to take possible legislation, the options open for executive actions are numerous. One step already taken has come from the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, which indicated in June that it will not sign off on tax inversions that are largely paper transactions, a move, though, that would have no effect on a company using a merger to effect a tax inversion. Eaton, the 101-year-old Cleveland-based equipment and electronic components manufacturer, announced in May of this year that it would acquire Cooper Industries PLC, another similar firm that had previously moved its operations to Bermuda and then to Ireland. According to the Wall Street Journal, Eaton intends to maintain factories, offices, and other operations in the U.S., while for now moving its place of incorporation to a law firm in Dublin. Stephen Shea, now a professor at Harvard Law School and a former Treasury Department official, recently wrote in the journal Tax Notes that the executive may be able to look at certain inversion transactions and define them as debt, when the companies themselves would certainly want the transactions to be seen as equity. Republicans in Congress seem to be staying silent for the moment as the administration considers executive stopgap action, a move that may signal tacit approval as Congress gears up to debate the issue. But most contend that the best way to keep U.S. business from leaving for tax purposes would be an overhaul of the U.S. tax code and reduction of the present 35% top tax rate on businesses, the highest corporate tax rate among developed economies. By comparison, Ireland's rate is 12.5%. The Obama administration has proposed lowering the rate to 28%, while some Republicans, such as Mitt Romney, had suggested 25%. But critics have also cited that the U.S. tax code, unlike most other developed countries, taxes the profits of U.S. companies made abroad as well as domestically. House Ways and Means Chairman Dave Camp, Republican of Michigan, said in a recent statement that comprehensive tax reform that lowers rates and transitions the U.S. to a territorial approach that is used by our global competitors is critical to making America a more attractive place to invest and hire. Barely a few months after its April approval by Russia's upper house of parliament, a new law in Russia has come into effect, imposing restrictions on users of social media and the companies that serve them. As we discussed back in April, the law will require bloggers with more than 3,000 daily readers to register with the Russian mass media regulator, conforming to regulations that govern the country's larger media outlets. Despite that, the bloggers will not benefit from any form of journalistic protections. Internet companies will also be required to maintain 6 months of data on their users, give access to Russian authorities to user information, and force these companies to localize their servers in Russia if they retain Russian citizen data. For many, Russia had for many years had relatively lax internet laws. Russia only recently seems to have changed its tune on this score, with Russian President Vladimir Putin branding the internet an ongoing CIA project. As pointed out by the BBC, it is hard to determine how the law will in fact be enforced, as the servers for most of the popular social media platforms that Russians use are based outside of Russia. The BBC also reports that many popular bloggers are already seeking and finding ways to ostensibly cheat the feature of the law that counts page visits, and thereby keep the daily unique visitor numbers that they have just under 3,000. There is a wonderful series of children's books by Laura Numeroff and Felicia Bond entitled If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, and If You Give a Pig a Pancake, and so on. And each book humorously explores the effects of our choices on what animals might do next. So what if you're a nature photographer and you give him a cack monkey your camera? Would he take a photo and then ask you for the copyright? The irony is that this is not too far off from the question being asked this past week as British photographer David Slater argues with Wikimedia over who owns the rights to a photo taken with his camera in 2011. That year, Slater had taken a wildlife photography trip to Indonesia. After some time in the bush, he was trailing a group of macaque monkeys. Having seemingly developed a rapport with the monkeys, some of them began mischievously playing with his equipment. In the midst of their jumping up and down, grimacing and showing their teeth, were many blurry exposures as buttons were pressed and flashes caused a bit of a frenzy. But then, there was one exposure where a female macaque monkey, seemingly grinning for the camera, took a simian selfie, and the rest is history. David Slater had explained to the Telegraph that he had gone through a great deal of effort and money to travel to Indonesia with his equipment, but according to Wikimedia, this does not change the fact that he himself did not take the picture. The monkey did. And as non-humans presently aren't afforded copyright protections under U.S., or for that matter, likely most developed economy laws, Wiki claims that the picture is open source and without a copyright. Slater commented to the Telegraph last week that a court case might eventually be the only way to determine who is the true owner of the image and a lawful copyright. But if that case occurs, he sees it unlikely that macaque monkey will have representation. I hope that Laura Numeroff and Felicia Bond have been following this, because If You Give a Macaque a Lawyer sounds like a great title. The BBC's Jonathan Webb reported this past week on a long-running collaboration among scientists, led by IBM, toward the development of a computer chip that mimics the organization of the human brain. The postage stamp-sized chip is composed reportedly of a million computational units, dubbed neurons, with each neuron on the chip connecting to 256 others. The BBC reports that the results of the collaboration are to be published in the journal Science, and one of the key features of the chip, and the type of computing that it represents, is that the processing style and computational power of the chip can pick out and distinguish the key elements of a visual scene in real time. The BBC's Jonathan Webb reports that the traditional style of computing since the 1940s is to have processing and memory separate, which is natural for sequential mathematical operations. However, the interconnected structure of a neuromorphic computing system is reportedly much more efficient at handling a lot of data at the same time. Instead of binary ones and zeros, the BBC reports that the units of computation here are spikes. The ability of a computer to differentiate a horse from a mailbox, or from a running boy in a visual landscape, is reportedly very difficult for conventional scalar processing, according to the BBC. And the prospect of this power enabling robotics to possibly aid in the search for survivors among a disaster scene is one hoped for but as yet very far off application. As the BBC reports, the chip, dubbed True North, is a huge accomplishment and very exciting, although some have said that the gains might be a bit overstated or perhaps too eagerly anticipated at present. The computational power, though it may trump a supercomputer, is not very far ahead of the latest smartphone that has the advantage of portability and minimal battery usage. And while impressive, the device reportedly pales in comparison to the biology of the brain that it attempts to emulate, where neurons send and receive something in the order of 10,000 connections each. Whether you are a human rights lawyer, a privacy attorney, embroiled in an international contract dispute, engaged in trade negotiations at the WTO, or looking to protect your copyright far from home, if you've been doing any of these things for any length of time, then you're familiar with the phrase rule of law, and particularly of late given the many current conflict zones in the world. Although a concept that has deep legal and societal roots and never out of fashion, it has become far more prominent in discussions over the past several years. What is the rule of law? In the 2004 UN report of the Secretary General on the rule of law and transitional justice in conflict and post-conflict societies, the UN put it this way. For the UN, the rule of law refers to a principle of governance in which all persons, institutions, and entities, public and private, including the state itself, are accountable to laws that are publicly promulgated, equally enforced, and independently adjudicated, and which are consistent with international human rights norms and standards. The UN's definition gives the impression of ordered society, certainty, and safety, with the existence and enforcement of laws creating almost a figurative island in the midst of what otherwise might be chaos. For those who studied the collegiate basics of philosophy and political thought, it would seem that the rule of law is an antithesis of Thomas Hobbes' state of nature, where the absence of any man-made law would leave all living creatures free to their devices and wills, as nature might have left them, if you believe Hobbes. Long before I heard the term rule of law and learned the UN's definition, came my own law school orientation, where we all watched the film A Man for All Seasons, the lyrical dramatization of Tudor society and the last days of Thomas More. Robert Bolt's amazing script has the character of More argue passionately to a young punk lawyer, one who was complaining of the density of the country's laws, that if you were to cut down the tall grass of laws throughout the country, do you as a person really think that you could stand upright in the winds that would then blow? Robert Bolt's Thomas More then memorably adds, "Yes, I'd even give the devil the benefit of law for my own safety's sake." Although wonderful, we don't necessarily need to look to Bolt's lyric dramatization to know that More's passion for the rule of law was renowned. The General Assembly of the UN has considered the rule of law as an agenda item since 1992, with renewed interest since 2006, and even adopted resolutions on the concept at each of its last three sessions. In the U.S., one of our most prominent scholars on the topic has been Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, who made the rule of law the subject of his keynote address to the International Bar Association's annual meeting in Boston last October. For Breyer, a seminal moment in the development of the rule of law was the Magna Carta, which he has referenced in his comments and opinions numerous times over the course of a lifetime in the legal profession. But for Breyer, and certainly for his keynote last year, he notes that the values of the Magna Carta and the rule of law have at times been championed simultaneously with elected officials using their victories at the polls as license to behave and push through policies they see fit, without regard for the other aspects of a functioning democracy. This is not too similar to a comment I heard from a colleague last year who, in discussions of adding the notion of rule of law to a document, added, "Whose law? Whose rule?" Even in full democracies, as Justice Breyer put it last year, issues of transparency, new technology, and the effect of globalization have led to disparities under the law. During oral arguments in the 2004 Hamdi v. Rumsfeld case, Justice Breyer noted that the words the Magna Carta were according to law, adding later that a person who contests something of importance is entitled to a neutral decision-maker and an opportunity to present proofs and arguments. Understanding the values ingrained in democracies by the Magna Carta, according to Justice Breyer, can not only help improve the creation of modern democracies, but also the functioning of existing ones. At the website of the World Justice Project, you can review the project's nine factors to their Rule of Law Index, which attempts to measure how the rule of law is experienced by ordinary people in 99 different countries. According to the Economic Intelligence Unit in 2012, there were 79 democracies globally, but they characterize only 25 as fully functioning. It is a marked increase, of course, from their non-existence in 1215, as Justice Breyer points out, when the Magna Carta was signed. But to which he added, even when you think that you have it, holding everyone equally to account under the rule of law still remains no easy feat. And that will be all again for us this week. You have been listening to 48MN5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, The Telegraph, The BBC, The International Bar Association, The World Justice Project, and the Economic Intelligence Unit. Thank you for listening. 48MN5 will be back with you again on Monday, August 18th. Until then, of course, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.